Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the FSR Policy Briefcase with me, James Nibon.
And me, Leonardo Meus.
I have to say, it was a real pleasure to have Ellen and Emma on the podcast last week to talk about electricity market design and some of the major reforms going on in that space following the recent energy crisis. And if anyone hasn't heard that episode yet, I really encourage you to go back and listen through it. I myself learned a tremendous amount. That being said, it is nice to be talking today about a topic that I know much more about and to have Leo somewhat out of his comfort zone. So today we're discussing clean hydrogen and industrial policy. And we are very lucky to be joined by the head of the FSR's gas and hydrogen area, Ilaria Conti. So very welcome to the show, Ilaria.
Many thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to join you today.
Yes, then it's me. I'm allowed to introduce the policy brief by Ilaria, by James. And I should mention also the two colleagues from the School of Transnational Governance, Jos Delbeke and Jan Cornili. They're not here today, but James promised to try to get a hold of Jan when he will be in Brussels. So you will normally hear Jan at the end of this podcast giving his thoughts. But I should say also that this policy brief was the outcome of a nice event you co-organized, right? A high-level policy dialogue between our two schools in October. And that led to this policy brief with five reflections on clean hydrogen contribution to European industrial decarbonization. That's dramatic, decarbonization and industrial together. So today I'm allowed to ask some questions. But before doing that, I think James was going to give some more background to this work.
Yes, exactly. So I think during the questions themselves, hopefully some of the technical aspects, RFMBOs and these kind of other acronyms and such should be cleared up and defined. But I'm going to try and give a quick overview of some of the context that sort of provoked the paper and, let's say, the event more broadly back in October. So although I said I was relieved not to be talking about electricity market design, I am going to make a quick link to today's topic just because the energy crisis was also hugely important in the storyline of European industrial transformation. So one of the things I learned from last week's podcast was that, in a way, the energy crisis was a catalyst for completing EU electricity market integration, right? So fundamentally, the crisis crystallized the vision that Europe was much more resilient as one than as 27. And this gave the sort of political impetus to complete tricky agreements, make the necessary investments, improve solidarity and interconnectedness between grids and markets, as well as introduce the technology and digital tools to capture the financial benefits of cheap, clean electricity, right? So seen in this way, the high prices were largely not an issue of the design of the market itself, but of the incomplete nature of its implementation in a way. So completing that implementation would go a long way to preventing similar crises in the future. In short, the market sort of did its job in the end. And if we stay the course with the direction we're going, we'll be in a better place for it. However, for industrial policy and more broadly, the decarbonization of hard to electrify sectors, we learned that the dynamics of energy intensive industries had changed, likely irreversibly, and that perhaps it was time to rethink the course we are on. I'm going to just try and outline that briefly here. So one of the critiques that Emma, Ellen and yourself, Leo, mentioned regarding the roughly 400 interventions, I think it was, in the electricity market during the crisis was the use of price caps, right? So the issue being that preventing consumers from being exposed to the price signal removes their incentive to reduce demand, and this keeps the pressure on the market, right, from the demand side. So retaining the price signal is important at the household level because it discourages consumers from wasting energy, encourages them to improve their energy efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. So simple things that can be done very quickly, modern insulation, draft excluders and the like, even turning down the thermostat, as well as more structural changes that may be expensive, but nevertheless relatively quick and accessible. So swapping a gas boiler for a heat pump, upgrading your windows and doors, these kinds of things. Supporting consumers with the upfront costs of these investments was a smart use of relief funds by member states, and it led to reduced demand and therefore lower prices in the market. However, the main area where demand was actually reduced was from the energy intensive industries, like ceramics, aluminium, and so on. So although it sounds intrinsically positive to have reduced demand and was often championed by politicians as a mark of the success of policy responses, these savings were largely not found from energy efficiency measures in the classical sense, but essentially from what you might call deindustrialization. So principally because industrial energy users are already highly rational and highly efficient, and their equivalent of cavity wall insulation or swapping out their gas boiler is often a complete value chain revolution. So requiring entirely new technology cycles. You can see the aluminium production, for example, in Europe dropped more than 12% from 2021 to 2022, further still in 2023, even though global demand for the product is rising. So to avoid chronic deindustrialization and all the negative repercussions that can come with it, public budget was used to increase their ability to pay. So industry was the second largest receiver of energy price relief during the crisis, with demand support tripling from 2021 to 22. So tax reductions, including for environmental taxes, direct transfers, cover the largest share of that. State aid rules were waived for long periods, and billions of euros were given to economically significant sectors to keep them operating. So not only did this expose huge differences in fiscal capacity between member states, which risk distorting the single market, it also exposed a significant shift in the long-term viability of European industry in a way that was different to other temporary shocks. So the fact that Russia was now at war with Ukraine meant a complete systematic shift in European energy flows, particularly all important natural gas flows. Russia had been supplying 45% of the EU's natural gas before the invasion, and not only was it the biggest single supplier, but it was also the cheapest. German industry in particular was heavily reliant on that exceptionally cheap gas, and as of February the 24th, 2022, that was no longer an option, and it would not be again for the foreseeable future. In this sense, industrial heat and power had become structurally more expensive, so with pricier liquefied natural gas filling the gap. Whilst Germany and more widely European fiscal support could get us over a sort of a short crisis, even these major economies cannot afford to have an industrial spine built on massive subsidization. At the same time, of course, this College of Commissioners has been pushing very hard to achieve deep decarbonization of the economy. There's been huge promotion of clean alternatives for industrial heat, including electrification of low and medium temperature heat, but also clean hydrogen for high temperature heat, and certainly as a chemical reductant and feedstock. So this is borne out in carbon taxes, phase out of emissions credits, production subsidies, research and innovation grants, state aid exemptions, and so on. Not only is this sustainability push about removing fossil fuels from existing industries, but it's also about capturing the new manufacturing sectors emerging in a net zero aligned world. So to be specific, this means both using clean hydrogen instead of natural gas or coking coal in steelmaking, and then using that steel to make an electrolyzer or an electric bike instead of an oil tanker or a gas boiler. So considering this net zero drive in parallel with the energy subsidy scheme for the incumbent fossil industry described previously highlights a sort of strange tension, right? So public budget and economic instruments being used both to accelerate the commercialization of new clean tech, but at the same time moving the goalposts of price parity further and further away. So even sometimes against market signals. And hydrogen, I think, is a really nice, clear example of this. So at some points during the crisis, renewable hydrogen in Europe crossed price parity with fossil hydrogen, owing to the high natural gas price and the stable real price of renewable electricity needed to produce that clean hydrogen. However, it didn't lead to an explosion in the demand for renewable hydrogen and a collapse in the production of fossil hydrogen, partially because natural gas was quickly subsidized, so distorting the market in favor of the incumbent and, as I said, moving those goalposts further away again. This is one of the reasons why we question in the paper whether the EU might simultaneously have its foot on the accelerator and the brake of industrial transformation. So this is just a somewhat brief summary of part of a very complex picture, of course, but it gives an important background as to why we wrote this policy brief. So how coherent are our policies and where are they leading? And hydrogen is a really nice prism to observe this issue, just because it's an energy vector that's bridging both the energy sector and the industrial aspects through its use as a feedstock and as a heat source. And it also has a place both in the incumbent fossil industries and in future clean industries.
Thank you, James. So I have lots of questions, but let me start with the simple one on terminology, Ilaria. Please, sorry, you have to apologize me because I know we talk about hydrogen in terms of colors, blue, green, all kind of colors have been mentioned. And you chose to use clean hydrogen as new terminology in the brief. So that's my first question on terminology. And the second one is you also refer to this new acronym that I guess everybody should know about because you're already able to say it quickly. I'm still practicing, so it's it's RFNBO, and if I understood, it's something like renewable fuel of non-biological origin. Please help me. What does it really mean?
With a lot of pleasure. So, yes, Leo, I mean, we did choose to use the term clean hydrogen, and it's not by chance. It's for at least two good reasons. One reason is that this term is comprehensive. So by clean hydrogen, we mean here both blue and green hydrogen. And the other reason is that, in fact, we can say that still nowadays, after years of discussion on a taxonomy for renewable and low carbon gases, we don't really have a complete taxonomy, almost like three quarters, more than that, but not totally completed. So, but for the benefit of those who are less, who haven't been involved actually in this huge, endless discussion, with the term clean hydrogen, as I said, we both mean green and blue, and this is basically the hydrogen that can be produced with a limited amount of greenhouse gases emissions. So, in short, it's clean because it doesn't pollute, and to some extent, we can talk of, we can include under this term both green and blue hydrogen. In the case of blue hydrogen, we typically refer to hydrogen produced via steam methane reforming with the addition of CCS technology, so carbon capture and storage. That's why it's blue. Otherwise, the hydrogen produced this way with steam methane reforming would otherwise be called gray informally. Whereas for when we talk about green hydrogen, we refer to that inappropriately in legal terms, but it's commonly understood as the hydrogen that is produced via electrolysis. Although we know that electrolysis is not the only way of producing green or renewable hydrogen, there are other processes, thinking of pyrolysis, I'm thinking of photocatalysis. But let's say that commonly green hydrogen is the hydrogen produced via electrolysis. And as we know, taxonomy and definitions of renewable and low carbon gases have been the object of long discussion within the EU. And what is certain at present is that only 0.3% of the hydrogen produced in Europe is of renewable origin, while more than 90% of the hydrogen that we currently produce is gray. So the type of hydrogen I referred earlier on, the hydrogen that is produced for industrial use and without carbon capture, so that it actually, its production releases greenhouse gases emissions. And the European legal definitions are much stricter, and they distinguish between renewable fuels of non-biological origin, to come to your question, the famous RFNBOs, and low carbon gases. So a specific methodology for calculating and defining the thresholds and the conditions for renewable RFNBOs is defined in delegated acts. So we have a framework of reference, namely it's the RED III, the Directive on Renewables. But then there are actually some delegated acts which specify even more stricter rules to understand how these RFNBOs can be actually defined. When it comes to low carbon gases, we are still awaiting for the complete definition. That's what I referred to in the intro, because even the latest hydrogen and decarbonized gas markets package doesn't complete the definition, and it points at the fact that there will be another delegated act to be published within 1 year after the entry into force of the package, which will hopefully finally complete this definition.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear. Let me then go immediately back to what I said in my opening, that there is a bit of drama in this brief, right? And the drama relates to the industry, you know, decarbonizing, hopefully staying in Europe or moving, right? That's hopefully not going to happen, or only to a limited extent. So if I quote the brief, you say, you know, instead of importing clean hydrogen and iron ore, we could simply, you know, and then create here this kind of sponge iron, which is a combination of clean hydrogen and iron ore. You could just do it, you know, immediately import this sponge iron into Europe. Or you could import, as you also said in your opening, James, ammonia or fertilizers, low carbon steel or renewable chemicals, right? We've heard this before. That's always a fear we have. But then my question to you is, you know, why would it happen now and did it not happen in the past? Because already we've been importing other type of, you know, we've been importing oil, we've been importing gas. So why did this kind of things not happen before, and why would it happen maybe for clean hydrogen?
Yes, no, I think it's a really fair question. And for sure, it's a very complicated issue. And definitely, I will miss some things in my response, because this is, in a way, it's sort of like the history of energy intensive industries in Europe, right? How they built out in this way. I would say maybe first thing to say is that in some ways, those energy intensive industries did build out following the cheap and available energy, which in the first instance was coal. And then moving to natural gas, yeah, was quite traumatic for the coal producing regions in Europe to lose that business to natural gas that was imported from third countries. But critically, natural gas can be relatively easily transported, much more easily than hydrogen, for example. So there's just like a supply chain optimization aspect to that as well. I would say, you know, going back to the birth of many of these kind of industrial clusters in Europe, they were birthed in a world that was perhaps not quite so globalized and integrated in terms of the availability of value chains to connect different regions in the world, but also the political and economic climate for globalization and international trade was different. And you could probably say that the movement of labor, the movement of skills, of expertise, technological know-how was not so fluid as it is now. So perhaps those barriers to entering those industries in other countries was more difficult. It, you know, once you've established that skill set in Europe or in, you know, different industrial clusters around the world, perhaps those aspects don't export as well. As I said, hydrogen is in itself a more difficult product to transport. So the hydrogen that we consume in Europe now is produced in Europe, but it's produced with imported natural gas. So you're kind of completely changing the value chain. And this issue about sponge iron is really because, in a way, it's easier just to put the iron, sponge iron, on the boat than trying to put liquefied hydrogen or hydrogen embedded in ammonia or LOHC on a boat or build the pipelines. We'll get onto infrastructure later. So in some ways, you can kind of optimize that value chain following the economic signals as they exist, right? More than that, I would say there's also a different culture and a different climate for how international trade is evolving and how Europe wants to engage in that. And sort of, let's say, offshoring some additional steps in value chains has become attractive as regards development policy and development finance in different ways to try and not create these commodity export dependencies with other countries that has existed in previous economic models, right? So trying to encourage not just the export of energy products from developing countries, for example, but also to try and build more complex value chains in those exporting regions to create more, like, let's say, complex economic models in those exporting regions. That being said, it has to be balanced against the interests of Europe to, of course, retain those economically attractive sectors, right? So, yeah, it's a fair point you say, and I think probably a combination of those aspects that I mentioned and much more besides.
Okay, no, thank you, James. And still on that point, you know, as an additional thing I remarked in when reading the brief is that you say, you know, this border mechanism we have, CBAM, right? Yeah. That it could even accelerate this, while I thought CBAM was actually introduced to keep industry here and to protect them, right? Yes. From imports that, you know, from regions where there is no carbon pricing.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is a really important point, I think, because, and it can be easily confused, but CBAM is designed to protect a greening European industry from being undercut by dirty imports. So it's not about trying to, you know, make Europe outcompete foreign competition in terms of like-for-like green, clean products. Not at all. You're essentially exporting your carbon price to third countries. And if they have the economic conditions to outcompete European industry on a pure cost basis, so this might be on energy price in these energy-intensive industries, it might be on land availability, labor, and so on, then they can capture that business. So it protects a decarbonizing European industry in a way because it's protecting it from fossil imports. But as I say, because you're essentially just exporting your carbon price, that's what the carbon border adjustment mechanism essentially does. It imposes the carbon price of the EU on potential trade partners. If those trade partners can compete with Europe on a pure cost basis, then they can have that business.
Okay. Let's move to something else. We're still a school of regulation. So, of course, I was also looking for the regulatory toolbox you discuss in the brief. And there are two parts to it, right? It's about creating a demand for clean hydrogen and about, you know, supporting the production or subsidizing or the supply, right? So first on the demand. So I understood we're back to this acronym that is RFNBOs must account for a certain amount of the hydrogen used in industry, moving away then from the gray, right, to the newly defined type of hydrogen. There are some percentages in there. And also I understood that it should be in the some fuel supplied in the transport sector. Again, there is a percentage in there. But could you just give us a feeling of how ambitious these sector obligations actually are? Because I don't really have a good feeling for that.
Sure. So, yes, there are a number of targets. There are also some targets that are not mandatory. So they just belong to the general vision that we understood Europe has about hydrogen in the future energy system. But I think in general, to respond to your question, I think that the sector obligations are quite strong and ambitious, particularly considering where we start from. Because we said on several occasions that the presence of hydrogen in the energy system and in the economy in general is still very limited, extremely limited, and restricted to some very specific use. So, in fact, the obligations, the sector obligations, and we can mention the fuel EU maritime regulation, the refuel EU aviation agreement, they both envisage sub-targets. In the case of maritime, it's 2% of the energy supplied to maritime transport that has to come from RFNBOs from 2033. And in the case of the aviation, instead, regulation, that is a 2% target of energy supply to aviation coming from SAFs, another wonderful acronym, Sustainable Aviation Fuels, which is a type of RFNBOs, by 2025. And this will even increase by 2030 up to 6%. So this is just to put some numbers in the context. But if we take one step back and we look at the general rationale of introducing targets for hydrogen in the system, I think we can even refer back to the very first energy system integration strategy, which is only from 2020. It feels like ages ago, but it's not even 4 years ago, where there, for example, there was a strong accent on the fact that clean molecules, what we call clean molecules and therefore also hydrogen, should only come after energy efficiency and after a massive electrification. And when it comes to specific targets, the hydrogen strategy also, which was published on the same day, also from 2020, did envisage some targets. It was 5.6 million tons of hydrogen, of renewable hydrogen, to be developed. And these today still appear as the most accurate target that we can think of, because in fact, these targets for renewable hydrogen cover just a little bit less than the current gray hydrogen production. So these targets seem to be quite reasonable. Then we had other initiatives, for example, the Repower EU, and there the targets substantially increased for hydrogen, as we know. We went up to 20 million tons of hydrogen by 2030, 10 of which to be produced internally and 10 to be imported. But as I said, these targets are not mandatory. They are not enshrined in regulation. So they are they were also included in the Repower EU, which was sort of reaction to the energy crisis and to the shortage in gas supplies coming from Russia. But at the same time, hydrogen has occupied a more important role, as we also understood from James in the introduction, which is really becoming one of the core pillars of the future industrial economy. And so I guess that the ambition lies probably here in this vision, which includes hydrogen as one of the important instruments, despite the fact that at the moment the presence and the demand for hydrogen is still pretty limited. I wanted to mention one important thing. I think if we're talking about regulation, one small but significant move with the RED II, RFNBOs could be considered renewable energy only when applied to the transport sector. With the RED III, RFNBOs are renewables regardless of the sector. So I think an important hint that hydrogen is not only limited to some sectors, but potentially in the future could expand to more sectors of the economy.
Okay, thank you for clarifying this topic of sector obligations. I think the other one got more attention in general, right? This hydrogen bank. So maybe James Ilaria is going to go first, I think, and then maybe James on this hydrogen bank. So it got a lot of attention, but it was not very clear to me, like, how does it really work? Who is going to participate in these auctions? Who's providing the money? And I also understood it can support electrolyzers, but it can support RFNBO capacity. So maybe what is that RFNBO capacity? And I might have mixed up who is going to go first.
it doesn't matter. I can probably just say a quick statement that the Hydrogen Bank was one of the probably most surprising and, you know, welcome, I think, initiatives. So along with the sectoral targets and the more classic, let's say, forms of support to hydrogen market development, certainly the Hydrogen Bank actually is one step forward. So the first auction concluded recently. We have some results, but it's too early to actually comment widely on the results and on the outcome. But I can recommend you an excellent podcast from James, who interviewed one of the persons behind the Hydrogen Bank, the European Commission, Joanna. So this is a little commercial for another podcast, but now I leave the floor to James,
who's actually the teaser of that podcast, James.
It goes without saying that Johanna explained much better than me the function of the Hydrogen Bank, but I will do my best job of sort of reproducing her explanation, which is to say that essentially the Hydrogen Bank functions a little bit like a contract for difference, just sort of making up the price that clean hydrogen needs to bridge to make it competitive with the fossil incumbent, essentially. So this is done on a project-by-project basis, sort of pay as bid, essentially, so not a flat credit, but rather a different level of subsidy per each project that bids. So the lowest bids get serviced first until the, in this case, 800 million budget that was allocated for this first round is exhausted. And then, yeah, you basically get the maximum amount of clean hydrogen in principle for this budget that you have allocated. There is a ceiling, so you can't be credited more than 4.5 euros per kilo. And as Ilaria says, we don't know at the time of recording where the bids were paid up to, which would be really interesting. And we do expect to get those results in the next few months. But as was noted in the paper, I think there were 132 bids, 17 EEA countries contributed. So it's not as if all the projects were just clustered very, very specifically. It'd be nice to get into the more granular details of that. And maybe also, as you mentioned, where's this money coming from? It's paid for by the EU's Innovation Fund, so it's actually, you know, EU-specific funds being used to service it. And of course, the Innovation Fund is part financed by ETS revenues. So in a way, it's this kind of circularity that goes in the opposite directions to the rather dystopian picture I was painting in the intro, which is to say that in a way, that is the fossil incumbent subsidizing this clean substitute, right? Which is, you know, in many ways how we'd like it to work, right? And I just wanted to complement what Ilaria said on the previous point about targets, and you were discussing these RFNBO targets, mandatory obligations and such. And I think it was interesting what Ilaria said, making the jump from what we have, let's say, if I can use the term historically, I mean, really it's over the last 5 years, but historically usually fixated on these targets that are done in tons, millions of tons, 10 million tons, 5.6 million tons, etc. But now we move more and more towards thinking of hydrogen not only as a product that we might want to consume for deep decarbonization. It still has that role, but it's also this vector for industrial transformation, not just for decarbonization, but for manufacturing these products. And that's about technology leadership and all these kind of more nuanced and ephemeral, hard to quantify notions of value that are not so easily expressed in a euros per megawatt hour or euros per ton of CO2 abated or something like that, right? So yeah, I think it's an important point to make.
Okay, thank you. Now we come to the classics. I mean, you cannot have a podcast on clean hydrogen if you don't discuss the classics. So one classic is blue versus green. So I read in your brief that the rules on blue hydrogen have not yet been finalized, while blue is back on the table due to the current low gas prices, right? Green hydrogen at current prices seems to be something like double the price of blue. While, of course, as you highlight in the brief, still many issues remain with blue. So my question is, can you give us your best guesstimate on what will happen next in blue versus green?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, this has been a stubborn issue that in some ways I sort of thought might have disappeared after the energy crisis when the gas prices went so high. As I mentioned, this crossing of price parity, I think, was really important in that regard. But as it is, because the prices came right back down again, we cite some numbers in the paper about the competitiveness with key commodities like ammonia, for example, which is also produced with natural gas feedstock. It just put itself back on the table because of this cost competitiveness. Likewise, recent news from the electrolyzer sector has not been super positive. The cost of electrolyzers actually increased recently. So these kind of learnings have not gone as exponentially far forward as we'd expected, at least for the moment. So anyway, as you mentioned, yeah, we don't have a certification system yet for blue hydrogen, and it requires lots of things like measurements of upstream methane emissions, obligations on capture rate. As Laria said, it's produced by capturing the CO2 that's produced from steam methane reforming, which is the process by which hydrogen is produced in large quantities now. However, the US, which is another important reference in the classical conversations on hydrogen policy, they followed the EU to a large extent on the certification of green hydrogen. But it seems like they're probably moving a little bit quicker than the EU on blue hydrogen. And although not confirmed, the early signs are a little bit concerning. So we'll hopefully have Maria Ogrzak on the podcast soon to talk about methane emissions. And she'll do a good job, I think, of covering these issues about emissions factors and the risk of emissions factors. But just to say that that's one of the criteria included in these proposed regulations. So the idea that you would have an emission factor for a value chain, not based on real actual measurements of leakages in the value chain, but rather just an assumed amount. And we've seen from various reports on emissions from even from the same regional sites, like in the Permian Basin, factors of 3 and 4 differences between the emissions factor, the assumed values, and the actual measured emissions. And unfortunately, that means that you can end up with a product that's, you know, incredibly emissions intensive because methane is such a potent greenhouse gas. So for me, this is a little bit bizarre. For me, the whole process, to be honest, of blue hydrogen production seems fraught with challenges because you're fundamentally trying to make something that's an incredibly emissions intensive product, natural gas, into something that's very clean, and it's sort of littered with loopholes. You know, it's a bit like trying to make a work boot into a running shoe. Like you can, you know, shave down the sole a bit and do the laces up tighter, but you still can very easily end up with something that's not fit for purpose. So as Ilaria mentioned earlier, the latest analyses that we see suggest we don't actually need that much hydrogen, really. And are we really that desperate to produce such vast quantities that it, you know, pushes us into needing to take these risks? And perhaps that's why it's taking so long to get clear certification, because, you do have to either do it really properly or risk leaving, a high level of exposure to criticism from detractors who might point to these potential losses, right? So it's also noted in the policy brief that if you go with a blue hydrogen model, which, you know, is very similar to the current model, just with the addition of CCS, this might even be done outside of Europe with the energy commodity imported. You lose all of the sort of co-benefits to do with technological leadership, the security implications that were, you know, really important strategically for the EU when they cited it in the RePowerEU document. All of these other aspects are lost. But nevertheless, if it's cheap enough, it will always be on the table, right? So, it's not a very good answer to your question, I'd say. But essentially, it's still on the table because the cost is so competitive and because there are major economies and major companies that are willing to invest in it. But really, you know, the conversation remains very abstract until we have clear rules and certification, really, that will decide it.
Oh, thank you, James. And I didn't know about the US, that they were already more advanced in this discussion. Very interesting. And it's also good that we will have Maria to talk about methane emissions, in that context, and I guess also just in general. Then the other classic, Ilaria, infrastructure. So we've seen lots of maps, right, on hydrogen infrastructure, but as we have just discussed, there is a lot of uncertainties. So not that easy to do the planning, right? So do you see some no-regret strategy emerging, or does it also remain a topic where there is no clear answer?
Yes, it definitely remains one of the topics where there is no clear answer. And again, because we know that infrastructure should be demand-driven, so we are back to square one. With the uncertainty in demand for hydrogen, there is consequently an obvious uncertainty in infrastructure development. But it's not enough. It's not a reply that we can be happy with. Considering all the efforts made and all the discussions around hydrogen, it is probably now we are at a stage where it's reasonable to start thinking about which infrastructure for hydrogen. There is a very good policy brief by a colleague of mine, whom you may know, James Kneebone, who has also been writing on which sort of infrastructure fits best to Europe's needs when it comes to imports, so LNG or pipelines. And this is just one addition to the main discussion, which is what sort of infrastructure will Europe need? Will we need an extensive network of pipelines like we used to have for natural gas? Probably not, because, again, it's very unlikely that hydrogen will replace natural gas in all its uses. Europe used to rely a lot on natural gas. It seems that instead, as we understand from today's discussion as well, hydrogen's usage will be limited to some sectors only. Therefore, there won't be the need of such an extensive pipeline. On the other hand, in the attempt of moving forward from this stuck discussion, chicken and egg, unresolved problem, the latest hydrogen and decarbonized gas markets package has some includes some provisions regarding infrastructure planning. And for example, one important novelty is the introduction of ENNO, the European Entity for Hydrogen Network Operators. And ENNO will be, of course, responsible for coordinating the efforts at infrastructure level for hydrogen, but at the same time, it will work together on the establishment of the 10-year network development plan for 2026 together with the ENSOG, so with the Network Operators for Gas entity. And it doesn't end here. Actually, the package also provides for the transfer of integrated planning from ENSOG to ENNO in the future. Actually, already as of 2028, ENNO will be solely responsible for the 10-year network development plan in hydrogen. So envisaging greater and greater powers for ENNO. And also the Commission includes a provision for reviewing the functioning of ENNO in 5 years, after the entry into force of the package. So this means that the future is, yes, still uncertain, but the Commission is, considering these latest provisions, is very serious about it and wants to provide for a clear development for the framework, for the regulatory framework for hydrogen, so that it can be integrated into the market, at the same time giving some flexibility in a first stage and then providing for monitoring, which is, in my opinion, equally important.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we covered the classics. Now, as we said in the beginning, we also still wanted to give space to the other colleagues that contributed to the brief. So we will go out of the studio with listen to James in Brussels talking to Jan Cornili. James, your turn.
Thank you very much, Leo. Indeed, I'm here with Jan Cornili, one of our co-authors for the policy brief, who's going to fill us in on a few of the issues that we didn't manage to cover in the studio. So very welcome, Jan. We're very happy to have you on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And what I'm really interested to get your opinions on, Jan, are the, let's say, like the pure economics of the sector, which I think we didn't really get into the details of during the recording earlier in the week. So do you have some views on this, like the cost projections that we put in the paper versus what we've seen from the industry so far, and what the implications might be vis-a-vis the objectives that we have and the roles we'd like clean hydrogen to play in Europe in particular?
Yes, and indeed the economics are very important in delivering the kind of policy goals that the EU has set with this hydrogen policy and wider the clean energy and climate policy. Because if we take a step back from the papers that have been produced and the strategies, basically what the EU is trying to do is three things at the same time. We want to reach our climate and energy goals through also the decarbonization of industry. And for that, we think we need clean hydrogen in order to deliver that industrial decarbonization. Secondly, we want to protect our industry from dirty imports. And for that, we installed a CBAM, which should protect the European industry as it becomes greener from its competitors who would still be fossil-based. And thirdly, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we also saw an opportunity to reduce the energy dependency of Russia and of fossil fuels and natural gas as a whole. Now, obviously, that only works when the prices are right. And the prices that matter a lot in this are the price of natural gas, the production cost of clean hydrogen, and a carbon price, which could correct this price of natural gas. And what we're seeing is actually that this is not going the way that has been anticipated. If you only look at the price of natural gas, it's back at pre-crisis levels. And the long-term outlook is not a huge increase in the gas price. On the contrary, with the abundance of gas that could flow into the global market and also to Europe from Qatar, from the United States, we see that actually the long-term outlook is rather a low gas price, which makes it harder for low-carbon alternatives to compete with. Now, the carbon price is there in the EU ETS system, and the CBAM could correct for that. But then, obviously, your production cost of clean hydrogen must be able to match this gas plus carbon price, which leads to the gray hydrogen benchmark. Now, the figure that is usually used in that context is around 2 euro per kilogram. That's where we would need to get to in order to have a chance to compete with gray hydrogen. And that price is actually dependent on the underlying cost of renewable energy and the cost of the electrolyzer. Now, what we're seeing is that, and the reports of the last years all show, and the evidence also from project developers as they are doing their feasibility studies, are showing that, well, it's going to take longer to get to that 2 euro per kilogram. We had hoped we would get there by 2030 by scaling up. Now already the industry is saying, well, it's going to be 35, it might be 40. So it's going to take longer to get to that 2 euro per kilogram benchmark with which we can compete with gray hydrogen. And secondly, what we're also seeing is that the underlying tendencies are not necessarily going in the positive way, because the renewable energy, because of interest rates, because of supply chain issues, have not become cheaper. And actually where this renewable energy is really cheap to make clean hydrogen, it's not in Europe. And then secondly, the cost of electrolyzer also in the last year has not gone down, has actually gone up. And this industry is still needs to scale to the kind of capacities that have been announced. So if you take all of that together, we are now in a situation where the production cost of hydrogen will take longer to get to the benchmark level of 2 euro per kilogram. The natural gas price is actually much lower than was anticipated during the crisis years. And then thirdly, the best chance of still hitting that price benchmark will not be in Europe, but will actually be in the European neighborhood, in the MENA region, where wind and solar is abundant and cheap. And so this raises the question of transport, because we know that we can make more cheaply renewable hydrogen in those areas, but then it's still not in Europe. So if we want to transport it, it either will take pipelines, or it will take ammonia ships, or it will take another carrier to get the hydrogen into Europe. And also there, from the evidence of the last years, we see that it's actually much more expensive than previously had been thought. We're talking about almost doubling the production price. Also, that could become less when we scale the whole industry. But all these factors together make actually a mix where the idea that we could do in Europe fuel switch from natural gas to clean hydrogen, keep our industry as it is, and fend it off against fossil fuel-based competitors is actually a bit in jeopardy. And at the very least, will not be delivered in the short term. It's going to take a long time, a long haul to get there. And that raises a lot of questions, actually, for the European policymakers, for the industry, on how we can get there and how do we adapt? How do the supply chains adapt? How do the import is structured? And there, you know, we need to have a clear vision on which part of the supply chain of green steel, of green fertilizer, of the refineries would still be in Europe and which part actually might move to the neighborhood, because there we can use low carbon hydrogen on the spot without transporting it and then transporting basically low carbon industrial goods into Europe. Mm-hmm. So the industrial question is turning out differently than had been anticipated by the policymakers. And I think a debate on that is necessary, and some rethinking about what this clean hydrogen in industrial decarbonization actually means is really important going forward.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jan. I think you touch on that important point, which is that the role of clean hydrogen in industrial policy is not a like-for-like switch. You know, this is not just about fuel substitution, because the economics suggest that it's not cheap enough to do that, and it's probably not even as cheap as we anticipated it to be, as quickly as we anticipated it to be. So in order to sort of justify that switch, that uptake of that new product, you have to tap into all those other kind of co-values that you mentioned. So the issue of security of supply, for example, the fact that it offers an opportunity for industrial modernization, new manufacturing sectors in Europe, these other kind of ideas of value that are not just competing on a pure euros per megawatt hour price or CO2 abatement per euros per ton of CO2 abated price, you know, which seems to be, based on what we see in the market at the moment, unrealistic benchmarks for clean hydrogen to hit, right? And I also like the point you raised about the CBAM, because we talked about that in the studio a little bit. Leo asked me, you know, wasn't the CBAM supposed to protect European industry? And now you're talking about offshoring European industry. But you raised the important point, which is that, you know, CBAM is about protecting against dirty imports. But, you know, you have a level playing field as far as green goods are concerned. So if there are other regions in the world that have more attractive economic conditions for producing those products, then absolutely they can. And, you know, Europe can benefit from cheaper products and promoting the production of those clean products abroad. But it's also a risk for decarbonizing European industry. So I think, as we said in the paper, it really requires a critical reflection on what industrial policy looks like moving forward. And unfortunately, that's more complex than a pure fuel switch.
Indeed. And if I could just add two more elements, like very recent elements, and which shows that the writing is on the wall. Thierry Leper of High Deal Spain came out saying, well, in Europe, it's only going to be Iberian solar and Chinese electrolyzers, that combination that could make competitive clean hydrogen. And that shows you that this is not what had been thought some years ago or had been promised. At least the Chinese electrolyzer bit is not. And then if you switch it on the other side, I think last week, Chariot and Total Eren have announced that they had their feasibility study done in Mauritania, where they have even cheaper renewable energy than in Spain, and that they actually could produce low carbon steel from Mauritania and export that into Europe. And so you see that the reality on the ground is shifting to those new facts and is shifting to a different pattern that had been realized. And all these elements, all these cases go actually in that same direction.
No, it's interesting stuff. And with things somewhat up in the air in that regard, with all of these different kind of projects, it will be interesting to see which ones really demonstrate a proof of concept that looks scalable, right? And I feel like somewhat in this policy brief and in our podcast for this episode, we've raised as many questions as we've answered. You know, it's certainly not the paper that comes with all the answers to the problem, but I think it gives us a lot of signals and a lot of signs to point to over the next 5 years or so that that should give us a clearer idea of where we're going, and some in the much more immediate future. I mean, we mentioned the hydrogen bank in the original recording. The data that we get from that might go some way to suggesting whether we need sector-specific access to those funds instead, so that they can compete to put it in the right sectors that we want it. All of these kind of things are still to be decided, but it will definitely need a follow-up analysis soon enough. So thanks again for joining us today, Jan, and I'm very happy to be recording in this beautiful office of yours with stunning views over Brussels. It's really nice. I enjoyed my time in Florence tremendously, but this is a really nice spot you have here as well. So
thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm sure they were excellent insights from Jan. I can be absolutely confident of that. And yes, thank you, Past James, for the excellent reporting and journalism over there in Brussels. And I don't know, with that, I think we can close. Thank you so much, Ilaria, for joining us. It was really a pleasure to discuss this. As I say, back on more familiar territory after 2 weeks on electricity business. Leo, did you enjoy it, learning about this?
Yeah. I especially like the acronyms on hydrogen. RF something, I don't remember anymore, but I'll listen to the podcast to try to remember.
Excellent. Thank you, guys. It was really fun. Thanks.